Detlev, I'm going to introduce you
to
the group. So, everyone, this is Detlev Arndt from EMBL in Heidelberg, Germany. And Detlev has been leading the Platineris Evo-Devo group in Europe for a number of years. And a lot of the key contributions to the modern view of both eye and photoreceptor evolution have come basically right out of this man's head, well, so to speak. And you'll see that the Platineris system is really fantastic, and they're doing a lot of really interesting things with it. So it's great to have you on video conference.
Thanks a lot. And thanks again for the invitation. I'm really looking forward, and I would propose, I quickly explain you where I am in the moment. So the institute I'm in, that is EMBL. Ever heard of EMBL?
Yeah,
that is right in the heart of Europe, as far from the next sea or ocean as you could imagine in Europe. So it's quite far for us, but still we are working on a marine organism. And as you said, I'm in the developmental biology unit at EMBL and working and having there an Evo-Devo group. So we have about 10 people in the lab. And as you will see, we are doing classical Evo-Devo study, but also some biophysics and neurobiology. So that is a mixture, and we have all sorts of expertise in the lab. And yeah, when you don't understand something, I would still say we have enough time that you just maybe raise your hand so that I can see there is something, and then put the question. But for you, I think you have to speak loudly that I hear you. Yeah, raise your voice. I think I just start. Okay. So I see the slide as it is in your room. That is also quite comfortable. The only thing is I cannot use the pointer. I have to use a lot of left and right, I think. So, but this first slide shows you what our main interest is, which is at the end the evolution of the brain, of our brain. And what really interests us are the very early steps. So from my perspective, I would say to trace the brain evolution or CNS evolution from a fish to us is not really a big deal. So you can recognize what a telencephalon is and what a cerebellum is and so on. But what is really a mystery so far is how everything emerged in the sea. And it's clear that it emerged in the ocean. And I don't know how well you know about theories of CNS evolution in the animal kingdom, but I think it is fair to say that this is really, in the moment, not known. So we do not, for example, really know well what the last common ancestor of, for example, us and the fruit fly, Drosophila, what kind of CNS this was. And we also don't really know about the animals and the brains that existed before, how it all started. On this slide, I have I've written that to find out about brain evolution, so the history of our brains, we have to do homology research, which basically means we have to compare development, cell types, and body plans to really unravel the evolution of the central nervous system. And for this, we have to not only look into vertebrates then, but also into other organisms, like the fly, or as we do, we have to look into annelids. So our approach is a comparative one. We look into the development, into the neurobiology of some weird animals that you will see in a minute to learn about the evolution of the brain. And how this works is very exciting in the moment. And this is really what is the breakthrough in the field in the moment, is that we can compare on the molecular level. A lot of the interest that there has been a lot of interest in brain evolution ever since, but I would say in these years, having molecular tools in hand that I will just present you in a minute, we can really unravel how the evolution worked. And so we go to the next slide. Yes, which summarizes what I'm going to tell you today, the whole approach. So you see a weird creature on the very left, which is a kind of flagellate. Anybody ever heard of these?
Yes.
The unit, yeah? unicellular organism. And the only reason why I'm showing this is that these quinoflagellates are our, well, say, it's the sister branch of animals. So it is pretty well understood now that the first metazoans must have resembled quinoflagellates somehow. And in the middle, the pictures you see there, this is a sponge larvae. And this is also an interesting animal because it has some cell types. It has few cell types only. And some of these already have some neuronal features. I'll get further into this a little later. And then on the right, you see the human brain, of course. And the complexity of the human brain is, of course, enormous, especially if you think in terms of cell numbers. Yeah, there are billions. But if you think in terms of cell types, the human brain doesn't have too many. So in fact, the human brain maybe has, this still counts in hundreds. And what I illustrate on the bottom of this, or below in that, on that slide, is cell type evolution. So this is meant to be the tree of animal evolution. And as you see, it starts with one cell type on the left, which then diversifies into two. This you see, right? And these two cell types are then inherited in the different lines of animal evolution, right? And so this is a very simplified scheme, of course, and there are many more diversification events. But if you go to the end of that tree, so to the right, you see these cell types would represent the animals that live today. And if you take the middle branch, there's a red and a blue cell type. And the red cell type is homologous to the orange and red below. Yeah. And also the blue cell types are shared between two organisms. And whatever diversification event produces cell types, these we call sister cell types. And comparable cell types between organisms we call homologous cell types. And all what we want to know is what are the homologous cell types, for example, between us and between a fly and, for example, an annelid, what I'm going to show you later. So what are the corresponding cell types in us and in these other animals? And within a species, we want to find out what the sister cell types are. And once we know all this and have understood their relationship, we know about the evolution of the brain. So that's the general approach. Is this somewhat clear?
Yep.
Yeah? And the new tools that we have now allow to recognize homologous cell types and sister cell types. So that's what I'm going to talk about, and we can go to the next slide. So the new tool I mentioned is that we can compare the cell types based on molecular fingerprints. So what people have always tried, for example, to compare photoreceptor cells, but only now we can reveal or unravel the molecular fingerprints of cell types. And for any cell types, per definition, there must be something peculiar about this cell type, and this must show in its so-called differentiation gene signature. So we are just the definition of a cell type is that there must be a unique combination of genes expressed that makes its peculiar and unique physiology and morphology. And this we call differentiation gene signature. This could be an opsin, for example, a special kind of opsin. And then each cell type also has a transcription factor signature or regulatory signature. And this is made up of the combination of transcription factor that is specifically expressed in a cell type. Yeah, if you take the rods and cones of our eye, for example, there's a certain combination of transcription factors that specifies it, and I will give many examples for this. So in this molecular fingerprint is now revealing the interrelationship of cell types, so homologous cell types and sister cell types, and this is what we are looking into. Next slide, please. And I don't think you have much of a zoological background, have you? So who knows what that is? Yeah, good. Yeah, this is an annelid, and I think you don't have to. It's also written that it is a lophotrophal zone, so that is just a name. But I think what is important for today is simply that this annelid lives in the ocean first, lives in the sea, so it's actually Neapolitan, comes from Naples in Italy, where it lives near the coast, in tubes. And important for us is that the last common ancestor of us and of the fruit fly and of nematodes was also the last common ancestor of this Platinarius domerilli, of this annelid. And whatever we find that is shared between the annelid and the vertebrate and due to and so similar that it is due to must be due to common heritage, must have also existed in the last common ancestor of us and in the fruit fly. And this famous common ancestor of all, basically all bilaterian animals, this is called Urbilateria. So you will ask yourself now, why on earth are they working on this organism? I mean, there are many organisms that are far better suited for many experimental approaches, so they must have a good reason. And I hope I can convince you that we have one. Next slide, please. So first of all, we have developed it as an experimental system, and it's working quite well now, so it took some time, but we have functional assays working now. This is just one example, morpholino injection. So this is what is currently ongoing in the lab. But this is just a technical detail if you want, and still other systems work much better. So maybe we show the next slide to explain you further why we have chosen this organism to work on it. And this is because it is a living fossil. And by this I mean that something very similar to Platinarius, yeah? On this bigger picture of this drawing, on this drawing by Simon Conway Morris, you see something that resembles an annelid. Yeah? Yes, exactly there. So the annelids, or more precisely polychaetes, existed in the Cambrian, together with a lot of other forms. So whatever you see in this single, on this individual panels, the preapolid, yeah, and the brachiopod, they are very ancient forms. And all these animals have in common that they existed for quite some time, say it like this. And the idea to work on Platinarius, so at the end, the reason why I started the molecular work on this when I began my postdoc, this is when it all started. The idea to choose Platinarius was exactly this one, that it to understand brain evolution and animal evolution, it's certainly a good idea to look into animals that haven't changed that much. Still, of course, this animal has seen 600 million years of evolution since Urbilateria once existed. But the idea is that the changes that accumulated afterwards are less than in other species. And I think this has worked out quite nicely. Maybe if we look into the next slide. This is a picture of the Platinarius brain. Now you recognize the face and the eyes. And below some cells. I will quickly explain what these cells are. These are neurosecretory cells. And the nice thing is that annelids, so we discovered that these annelids have hormones and neuropeptides like vasopressin, which is the orthologue of vasopressin and isotocin, or oxytocin, or GnRH, which is the gonadotropin-releasing hormone, or POMC, which basically means, unexpectedly, they have a vertebrate complement of neuropeptides and hormones. Which was unexpected because, for example, a fly or a nematode doesn't have it. For us, the insight was that apparently this hormone system is not vertebrate specific, but existed, is much older than we previously assumed. And for us, it's also nice that at the end, vertebrate pharmacology works. So we can use all the, say, human medication like Prozac and so on, and it will also work in an annelid. And we can use this also for our experiments. I show some examples later. So next slide, please. Okay, and this is now a short introduction into Evo-Devo, what we actually did with this organism in the past year. And what you see here is, I would say, classical Evo-Devo stuff. Essentially, I'm showing a vertebrate and Platinarius, so our organism, and you are looking on the dorsal, at the dorsal side of this vertebrate and the ventral side of Platyneurus, you see the midline in both cases. And this is essentially, of course, where the central nervous system develops. And then you see a more complex graph always at the bottom, which is illustrating that these nerve or nervous system anlagen are subdivided into columns. And these columns all have a different combinatorial code of transcription factors expressing or specifying these columns. And if you first look into the vertebrates, so you see all these gene names, like PAX6 and NK6 and so on, and you see that these genes are expressed in a way that the vertebrate neural plate is subdivided into these specific columns. And maybe you can point out the column that expresses PAX6 in gray and NK6. So this yellow, grayish one. So this goes from anterior to posterior, yeah, and this, so this is how the vertebrate neural plate is specified. And what we found for Platyneurus was basically that a very similar pattern existed in Platyneurus, so pattern of transcription factors specifying this nerve code anlage. Yeah, I think you can appreciate that it is not exactly similar, but that it is very similar. And this was the main message of a paper we had last year, saying basically that this molecular patterning of the nerve cord anlage in our worm Platyneurus and in the vertebrate is very similar. And this is a classical case then of a homology postulate. So what we are saying is that this is similar due to evolutionary heritage and that it is very difficult to explain otherwise, for example, by independent evolution. So this means that there's something like a shared molecular topography in animals where nobody would have expected this in the developing nervous system. And then, of course, the exciting question came up, what does this mean for nerve cord or for CNS evolution? If you just show the next slide, please. One implication of this, which is more of interest than for zoologists, that are interested in the whole body plans, is that the ventral side of our species and also of the fly, for example, corresponds to the dorsal side of vertebrates. And this is a nice confirmation of actually an old theory that vertebrates have inverted their dorsal ventral axis in their evolution. How exactly this happened is still, of course, a matter of debate, but the molecular data is quite clear on this. And So Ubalateria might have been annelid-like or burrowing, and there could have been a phase like this ancestral Amphioxus-like ancestor that I'm depicting on the left. Yeah, that was more or less ambiguous in dorsal ventrality, but then vertebrate continued to swim on their former dorsal side, which now became ventral. And so their nervous system is located now dorsal, and it was ventral before. This is not a big deal, and it doesn't involve any rearrangement of organs, it's just a change in posture towards the environment, that's all. Yeah? But it can be otherwise confusing, because you know that the ventral nervous, that annelids have a ventral nervous system and we have our dorsal nerve cord. Okay, next slide please. And what I just said about the medio-lateral patterning of the CNS is also true for the anterior-posterior axis. Also here, I wouldn't go into detail, I just want to show that the past years have revealed that animals are also from the front to the end, to the rear end, revealing similar molecular regions. For example, what is labeled in blue is at the very tip of the body axis. This is where the brain, the actual cerebral ganglia, develop in the polychaete. Yeah? As well as in the vertebrate. So for the moment, I mean, I think you will see or you learn from this that all these bilaterians are somehow subdivided into similar regions. What is called molecular topography. And the question, just to repeat it, is what does this mean for our understanding of brain evolution? And so the next slide, please.
Question?
Yes?
So the definition of these regions in this case is based on molecular identification, or is it
yes.
just
okay? It is completely molecular. These are this is at stages where you don't see much of in invertebrates, for example, you don't see much of a morphological difference. So in this case, it is the definition is by molecules exactly.
So it's not anatomical in the earlier organisms.
No, it's not.
Okay.
Of course, this develops into something anatomical, and the question is, of course, whether. I mean, there are basically two ways to interpret this molecular similarity. One is that it is something like a simple coordinate system. And then it wouldn't mean much about the actual anatomy or cell types. The other possibility is that these regions are so similar because they give rise to similar things that develop from these. And the idea that we have come up with is that these regions give rise to similar cell types. Yeah, so this is the hypothesis coming from our lab and also from others. And I can give you one example now for this.
Exactly.
Just to illustrate, next slide, please. So this is what Christine looked into, who is a postdoc in the lab, who's now having, she's now leaving and having her own group, working on still on the same thing. But what Christine looked into, what was on the previous slide, this blue region at the very tip of the head. And, yeah, exactly, so this blue region here in the polychaete and in the vertebrate, and she looked further into genes that subdivide these regions further. And this is, if you go ahead now. So she looked into forebrain regionalization in platyrrhines and fish, and now this is like a higher resolution of what I've just shown of this blue region. It is further subdivided into three subregions, defined by the overlap of three genes. So the name do not matter, but it's essentially again the same pattern. So we have one gene in the medial region, which is NK2.1, then we have PAC6 more laterally, and in the very front we have RX genes, right? This you see. And again we have an overall similar arrangement in the two species. And now the question emerges. So in both pictures we have in both animals, we have a very specific overlap, for example, of the green gene and the orange gene, right? So RX and NK2.1. This exists in the fish, developing fish brain, and it also exists in platyrrhines, exactly. And the question that Christine asked now is whether from these regions have anything to do with each other in the two organisms in terms of cell types that develop from these regions. And this is visible on the next slide then. So she looked into additional genes and she found that the cells that are depicted in white in this summarizing scheme are the only ones co-expressing these three developmental genes in the developing platyrrhines brain. So blue is PDURX, red is PDOOTP, and green is NK2.1. And you see exactly, these cells are co-expressing the genes, all three genes actually. On the upper panel you see how these cells are located with respect to the developing axonal scaffold. They are exactly between these ciliated cells, yeah, there. So, and they correspond to the white cells in the graph, exactly, very good. So this is actually a unique molecular identity. You can say that these are the only cells, maybe 5% of the total, that co-express the three transcription factors. And if you now go to the next slide, these are the only cells that express this vasopressin gene that I mentioned. So the whole platyrrhine's brain, they're just these few cells medially located of these conspicuous cilia that stain with the antibody. Yeah, these cells are expressing vasopressin and co-expressing the three transcription factors. So we found a very specific molecular fingerprint for the vasopressinergic cells in the developing platyrrhines on the one side. And when Christy looked in now into a completely different animal, so into the zebrafish. next slide, please. She found the very same thing. So also here you don't have to look into the detail, just to indicate that this area encircled in white is uniquely defined by the expression of the same transcription factors, OTP, NK2.1, and RX. They are co-expressed only there, and these are exactly the same, the cells expressing vasopressin in the fish developing embryo. So this is a clear case of a shared molecular fingerprint, and developing from the very same region in an annelid and an invertebrate. And the straightforward explanation for this is that this is homology, so that this is actually due to a common heritage and existed in the last common ancestor. So what we learn then from this is that Ubulateria had vasopressinergic cells in its brain with a certain molecular profile. And if you go to the next slide, this is summarized. No, this is just an additional detail. There's also a microRNA. So for those interested in microRNAs, which is specifically labeling these vasopressinergic cells as well as a few others. This is an interesting perspective also for microRNAs, that they might be very good markers also for conserved cell types. It's still not clear how general this is a function of theirs. So next slide, please. So this is maybe a little complex to explain without a pointer, but you see the annelid on the very left and the vertebrate on the very right, and you see in all panels you see these dark gray cells, which are these FMF amidergic cells that I haven't mentioned yet, but then you also see the light gray ones in the vertebrate and in the annelid that I just talked about, these vasopressinergic ones. Yeah, you see this? And if you click again, then there comes some additional label. Exactly. So for these the vasopressinergic cells, from the molecular fingerprint, we also know that they are cells expressing C-opsin. So this is also part of their fingerprint. And then it gets interesting. For example, we can say we know that these cells express vasopressin, but they are at the same time photosensitive. And so you can start speculating about the function of these ancient cells. For example, the molecules indicate that they are photosensitive as well as secreting something that will influence reproduction. And for this, it's important to know that there are seasonal and daily fluctuations of hypothalamic vasopressin release in many vertebrates. So knowing about the molecular fingerprint also allows speculating about the function of these cells, and like this then also to brain evolution, because like this we know that cells with a similar function existed in the common ancestor and probably were able to directly photoregulate the release of vasopressin. Okay, any question at this point?
I have one question. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes?
What's the most sensitive method that you used to show that the vasopressin gene is not expressed in any other cells? Go ahead.
Yeah. So this was a study that actually took the postdoc 2 or even 3 years to find out about the co-expression of these cells by so-called fluorescent double Hohlmann in situ hybridization, where we simply put 2 probes into the same larvae and then see whether it co-expresses. But I will show you later on a technique that we have developed now that is very straightforward to reveal co-expression of genes in single cells. This is actually a novel technique that I will show you now. So the answer comes a little later. Other questions? Okay. So these are good. It's also a good example of that ancient cell types are multifunctional. So what I show here are 4 examples of cells that existed early on in evolution, apparently, that harbor several functions, are multifunctional. One is the guanoflagellate I talked about in the beginning. Then there is a very nice example existing in the sponge larvae I showed in the beginning, the second one, the photosensitive steering rudder cell. This is actually a cell that is everything. It is a photoreceptor, it is a shading pigment cell, and it is a motor cell because it can move the cilium for the steering in phototaxis. This is a nice example of a multifunctional cell. And then lower metazoans have epithelial muscle cells, so these are cells that are both sensory as well as contractile. And then the cell I just talked about is a typical CSF contacting neuron. These vasotocinergic cells and also the FMF amidergic cells, they are both sensory and neurosecretory. And this is one very important point that I'd like to make, that ancient cell types are multifunctional. And I will later on get back to the point that CNS evolution is about the functional segregation of cell types. This will come in a minute. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, we then tested whether what we found for this vasotocinergic cell is also true for other cell types. Here I can be a little faster maybe. So in principle, what you see here is this mediolateral regionalization scheme for vertebrates and annelids. And of course, in vertebrates, it's well known what cell types develop from what region or from what column in the vertebrate. And for these cell types, we simply tested whether the platinarias regions would give rise to similar cell types. And on the next slide, yeah, this is one example that we, okay, these are Gaspar and Alex who did the work. Gaspar is also a postdoc who just left the lab, and Alex is a PhD. Next slide, please. So invertebrates, somatic motor neurons develop from a very specific region in the neural plate. And if you go to the next slide, Gaspar and Alex produced a lot of data essentially revealing that in our annelid the situation is the same. So here I don't have to explain the details. We can just go to the next slide and learn that these cells, which are the HB plus positive, so the HB positive somatic motor neurons, they come from the same column in platinarias and invertebrate. Yeah, it's essentially making the point that we have indeed similar cell types coming from similar regions. Okay. Yeah, next slide, please. So that's something like a summary of this first part. That we have a conserved molecular topography in neurodevelopment, and that the comparison between an annelid and a vertebrate reveals that this translates into a map of conserved cell types. And the more of these cell types we reveal, the better our knowledge gets of the ubiliterian central nervous system. So everything that is in this map now has been part of the ubiliterian nervous system, right? Okay, next slide. This is the same thing in now a more realistic variant. So again, you see a vertebrate early developing brain with the first cell types on the left side, and on the right side, the early developing annelid brain. And I just want to give you one example of an additional cell type that we found conserved. So this is already, I think this was published in 2004, and you see the violet cell types in the vertebrate are the rods and cones of our retina, right? Can you see this? So they're in the, yes, yeah, almost. Yeah, the rods and cones are part of the retina and are depicted in violet. And what we found was that these rods and cones share the molecular fingerprint with cells that you find in the annelid, exactly located in the brain, exactly there, right? So these are also ciliary photoreceptors. So The molecular fingerprint comparison revealed that the vertebrate rods and cones stem from a population of ciliary brain photoreceptors that in Platyneraeus, as well as in many other invertebrates, is residing in the brain. It's not part of the eyes. From this, of course, an interesting conclusion emerged for eye evolution. I can show on the next slide. So if our photoreceptors of the retina are derived from a population of photoreceptors that initially resided in the brain, then we can now understand why the brain is why the vertebrate eyes, why our eyes in development actually emerge from the brain. So the brain vesicles evaginate, the eye vesicles evaginate from the brain to then form an eye cup. And in this case, development recapitulates evolution. And the whole thing, what happens is that like this in evolution, the population of ciliary photoreceptors that was initially in the brain got closer to the surface and finally evolved into an eye. So if you go back one slide, back one slide, please. Yeah, exactly. That's right. So then, of course, you can ask yourself, why then did vertebrates recruit these ciliary brain photoreceptors for their eyes? And the story is even more complicated because invertebrates also have eyes. Yeah. So on the right side, where you see the annelid, there's an eye that is on both sides that is composed of just two cells, an orange receptor cell and in gray a pigment cell. It's LE, it's labeled LE, the larval eye. There are also adult eyes labeled AE. And these larval eyes, they have photoreceptors. And we also found the counterpart for these photoreceptors in the vertebrate retina. So the orange cells there are the ganglion cells. And this was now a crazy story in a way, because the ganglion cells, they recently identified still as photoreceptors, so they have the same opsin as these Platyneraeus larval eye cells, but in the vertebrate they are non-visual. Yeah? They are for the entrainment of the circadian rhythmicity. So what happened in vertebrate evolution was that for some reason they did not take the raptomeric photoreceptors, these orange ones, which in all invertebrates perform visual tasks whenever eyes are present, but they took another population, the ciliary photoreceptors, that they recruited for the evolution of these lateral eyes. I think this is also an interesting point to keep in mind when it comes to the question whether the eyes as such of an invertebrate and of a vertebrate are really homologous. Yeah? Is this point clear, or
question?
Maybe?
Yeah.
Just
one question.
I'm on the side over here.
Yes.
That's rather reminiscent of the larval eye that persists into the adult fly that is involved in circadian photoreception. And I don't know what its I don't know what its molecular signature is, because I don't know if that's been looked at. But there is a carryover of a larval eye that ends up in the optic lobe of the adult that is devoted to circadian photoreception.
Exactly. There's this bulbic eye that persists, and it was found that it even persists into adulthood, into this eyelet in the fly. And it's exactly true. It is involved in also in circadian rhythmicity, in the setting of the clock, I think. Right. And the only thing is we don't know yet for the annelid. It is very possible that this is the same larval eye, I would say. But we have not yet shown this with molecular markers. We are working on this actually in the moment. So Karen in my lab is characterizing the differential molecular fingerprint of the larval eye and the adult eye, and we are exactly interested in this question, whether there's any even connection between larval eyes, for example, in these remote organisms like fly and worm. Exactly. Other questions? No? Okay, then we go on. We had. Yes, next slide, please. Okay. So then, knowing about the fingerprints, you can construct something like a tree for the evolution of photoreceptor cells. And the tree of ciliary photoreceptor evolution is depicted on the right side, and you can see that the rods and cones on the very right are sister cell types. And the tree also reveals that vertebrates have a cell type at the base of the vertebrate, which is not a rod or a cone. And this is depicted on the next slide. Yeah, no, sorry. This is now, maybe you go on one slide, please, or two. This we can leave out because I see that time is already progressing. Next slide. Yeah, so I'm talking about the fourth or the fifth cell on the vertebrate side, which doesn't look like a photoreceptor. And this is a point I would like to make, because by molecular finger, exactly that one, yeah, that one, right. That one is clearly related by molecular fingerprint to the rods and cones. And this is a bipolar cell, which by molecular fingerprint can be identified as sister cell of rods and cones. And on the next slide, there's a lot of evidence for this. This point has also been made actually in a very, very nice recent review by Lamb et al. In 2008, that the bipolar cells and the rods and cones are related. So there's the bullet point show you that they have a shared molecular regulatory signature. Yeah, they also share a lot of molecules on the differentiation side. They have similar ribbon synapses, G protein cascades, so quite peculiar features. And they have even a similar cellular morphology. So in fact, the bipolar cells early on form the so-called Landolt's club, or a subset of these forms the Landolt clubs, which resemble the outer segment of a rod and a cone. And early on in differentiation, rods and cones also form retina-spanning axons like the bipolars do. And what is depicted on the lower right and comes from the work of Thess Blackshaw is that they also have a similar overall expression profile. And this now gives rise to a nice hypothesis, which is depicted on the next slide. How can we... What is this information saying? So if we know that bipolar cells and rods and cones are sister cell types, are closely related, why are they so different? And this is now a key point I would like to make. So this is an hypothesis for the evolution of rods and cones and bipolars. So the situation, it's an evolutionary scheme. The situation on the left is that we still have a precursor of called R, C, and B, so a common precursor for rods and cones and bipolar cells. And they are interconnected by axons, but they are all similar. And that then something happened in evolution that I'd like to call functional segregation. That now a subset of these precursors developed into the direction of photoreceptor cells, so something like a rod-cone precursor, called RC in the middle panel, and that at the same time then another subset of these cell types developed into something that reduced or lost the photoreceptive function and developed into a bipolar cell. And on the right then you see the end state where we have distinct cell types like cones and rods and bipolars. And so this is the scenario for the evolution of sister cell types, which you can recognize by similar molecular fingerprints. And I think you will appreciate that at the same time, it's also a nice scenario for the evolution of a neuronal circuit. Yeah, because these cells simply stay interconnected by axons. They always did so, but this never changes. And by them getting different and diversifying, now they can also relocate to different places and like this, develop into or evolve in a new axonal circuit. I think this is an important point for CNS evolution, because it is otherwise hard to figure out how something like an axonal circuit should emerge in evolution. I mean, it would be functional only when the axon really reaches the other cell type. And this is a nice way to figure out how neuronal circuits really came into place. I think on the next slide I'm showing another example.
Can I just make a comment there?
Yes. Yeah, sure.
This is a very attractive hypothesis for a number of other reasons. First of all, we know that in limulus, in insects and in vertebrates, they all show lateral inhibition and signal amplification at this level. And work that we did many years ago shows that this is analogous processing that's optimized for the particular problems of efficiently upcoding images with photoreceptors. In addition, the eccentric cell in limulus, which is the interneuron which performs lateral inhibition, is a modified photoreceptor. It has microvilli and it participates in the very base of the rhabdome. Thirdly, in mollusks, many photoreceptors show quite complicated patterns of processing at their proximal ends that are not seen in insects. So there seems to be something about doing more processing when you deliver your signal when you're a photoreceptor. That's a good thing to do. But we don't, as far as I know, we don't know anything about the embryology of the limulus. And nor do we know, it would be interesting to see whether the neurons in insects, in the insect lamina, were in any way related to photoreceptors or whether they have a completely different origin.
I would actually expect this. It's exactly the point. So this scenario following this sort of functional segregation, the idea would be that existing neural circuits from today evolved by functional segregation and then moved apart from each other, so that cells like the lamina and the photoreceptor themselves would be closer related than maybe previously assumed. Exactly. Yeah. I'm showing another example. On the next slide. I don't know how much I should explain this, but it's essentially a similar story. So for those who like Lancelet and, well, anybody knows what Amphioxus is in the room? I guess, yes? So people have always wondered where something like the pituitary comes from in the vertebrates. And Amphioxus has now an identified homolog, which has been identified by molecular fingerprint by the expression of a very specific transcription factor, PID1, and also by the secretion of related hormones like gonadotropin and LH and gonadotropin releasing hormone. So the molecular fingerprint clearly identifies an homolog in Amphioxus. And now I think the exciting point is that the molecular fingerprint also clearly says that this organ is not only related to the pituitary invertebrates, but it also has features of the cells in the hypothalamus and even of the olfactory placo. So if you go to the next slide, I'm presenting another neuronal circuit that evolves by neuron type segregation. So on the left you see cells that are in Amphioxus still one cell type, being both sensory and neurosecretory, secreting something like gonadotropin, releasing hormone and gonadotropin. Then in the middle slide you see that the first diversification event has somehow separated gonadotropin releasing hormone and gonadotropin secreting cells from the actual sensory cells. And that, then on the right, you see that some cells specialize on olfaction, so these are now in the nose. Then some on gonadotropin releasing hormone, these are now in the hypothalamus, where they can well integrate with other neurons. And this third sister cell type is now in the pituitary. And this is interesting for developmental biologists, because they can now understand why all these three cell types come from a more or less common olfacto adenohypophysal placode, so from one and the same placode in the developing vertebrate. Then you can understand things like why cells that are finally situated in the hypothalamus migrate along the olfactory nerve to reach to be there. And why, for example, you have a lot of GnRH-positive cells still in the olfactory system, which is non-understood. So this example tells the same story. It's a well-known neuronal circuit where the molecular fingerprint comparison reveals that it apparently evolved by sister cell functional segregation. Yeah? And just another example. is about, which is older and has been put forward by Mackie, is that the muscle epithelial muscle cells that you that cnidarians have, yeah, by functional segregation gave rise into distinct muscle cells, motor neurons, epithelial cells, as well as sensory cells. And there has been recent molecular data supporting exactly this. Yeah? Next slide, please. Okay, how is it time-wise? When should I stop and what is the situation?
We can have another 20 minutes or so. Is that okay for you? Or do you need more than
That's
that?
That's perfectly fine with me, yeah?
Okay.
You just interrupt me if it's going too long or whatever, yeah? So here I want to quickly show our technique. So getting back to the previous question, of course, having put forward these hypotheses and scenarios, of course, we would love to know the molecular fingerprint of all the cells in the platyrrhine's brain, right? And we would also love to know the molecular fingerprint of all cells in the vertebrate brain, just to do a large-scale comparison of everything. And here on this slide, you see the sort of data that we have. So these are all expression patterns for different genes, always counterstate with the same antibody. And what exactly we want to know, of course, is whether the same cell expresses the same gene, but it's very hard to just cross-compare between two stainings, right? So you can never really say whether the same cell is staining or not. It could also be the exact neighbor cell. So what Raju in the lab, next slide please, developed recently was a technique exactly asking this question. So if this, what you saw before, is a whole postdoctoral work, how can we speed up? So what he did was, next slide. So that shows Raju, who is a person combining bioinformatics skills with bench skills, and that's very nice. He developed what we call whole mouse in silico expression profiling. So he's now superimposing or aligning expression patterns with a computer. And what you see on this slide is the same, saying the same as you saw for this postdoctoral work. It's the same three genes, and you also see the same co-expressing cells demarcated in white. But now this whole thing is aligned by the computer, and it comes to the same result, just as a proof of principle. So what we do is visible on the next slide. Raju is taking the axonal scaffolds of two larvae, and you can already appreciate that they are very similar. So these are the axons of the early developing nervous system. It's highly reproducible from larva to larvae, and what he does is visible on the next slide. So he's using computer algorithms for image registration to register something like average scans of gene expression onto a common scaffold, onto an average brain model, and uses this then to find out about co-expression in silico. Next slide, please. This is proof of principle. If you stain two different larvae for the same gene, counterstain for the axonal scaffold with the antibody, use this for registration, and then let the computer align the two, then you see an exact superposition of the staining for the same gene in the two cases, and this is with cellular resolution. So our animals develop so stereotyped that you can obtain cellular resolution here, and then on the next slide, you can see what we are currently doing. We are simply, this is all generated with a computer, and it is an expression profiling on cellular level. In red are always the same cells aligned with different genes, and white gives you then a clear answer what is co-expressed and what is not. And this is another slide that I did with Raju in 2 hours, always showing the same stacks from, I don't know, numbered 62 to 66, and it is exactly telling the same story as this as the work of another PhD who took the same gene and did in hand double co in situ and came to the similar result. So this is for us very exciting because this is now a large scale. And it's the same as if you did single cell expression profiling by microarray, for example, for the vertebrate cell types. Just as a perspective, so these are exciting times. This is all then, since we have cellular resolution, the computer can more or less then decide whether a gene is on in a certain cell or not. And Raju has constructed a cellular model of the platinurea's brain, and then by computer finds out about the expression profile of every single cell. So this is, no, it's fine. You can go to the next slide. Next slide. So the result of this is single cell expression profiling. This has just started. So on top are the different genes that are in already, but this will quickly go into hundreds, and to the right are the single cells that all get their profile. This is like a big microarray study, if you want. Okay, this is technique. And now, if there is still time, I would come to the last part.
There is a question.
Sorry? Yes, question.
How many cells are there in the platinurea's brain?
Well, I used to tell a few hundreds in the brain. Actually, it's 2,000. So the brain alone is 2,000 cells. So the cellular model is giving a clear answer. It's more than we expected. Other questions? Okay, maybe you will believe me that this technique will help us to find out a lot about sister cell types and homologous cell types between annelids and vertebrates. And to at the end get... So if you do this, the same technique, for example, in the vertebrate, you will get something like a cell type diversification tree for neuron types for animals. And as long as this is congruent between an annelid and a vertebrate, I would say, if this works, we will know in a few years the complete cell type diversification tree for brains in animals. This is ambitious, certainly, but I think it's possible now. And then comes the next question, which is, if these cells existed in Urbilateria, what did they do? And so this is another field of research where there's a lot of progress in recent times. And now the next slide, please. Gaspar looked into these, you remember these orange cells, these larval photoreceptors that we discussed about. So he wanted to know about their function in phototaxis and started a collaboration with François Nedelec, yeah, who's a mathematician and also a biophysicist. So Julian Colombelli, who's in the Stelzer lab. This is all at EMBL. And next slide, please. He is interested in phototaxis. So these are the larval eyes of platinurea's with a natural pigment. As you remember, they just consist of two cells. No, it's fine, you can go to the next slide. And all they do is that they move the cilia of the ciliary band, and the ciliary band is what these larvae use for swimming. So you see, these are the swimming larvae of platinurea's. And there must be one of the first function of the nervous system is phototaxis, and he wanted to find out how this works. Next slide, please. This is depicting platinurea's phototaxis in real image, so in the recorded in a phototaxis chamber. Now the light is on and they all swim towards the light, you can see this. And Gaspard traces this with image J. This is the black movie on the right, which depicts the movement of single larvae. So it's easy to quantify and to put into the computer. Next slide, please.
Is this a movie also?
No. Gaspar found out that they swim in helices. So they swim in spirals. You can leave this, it's fine.
Is this a movie?
No, this is no movie.
Okay.
So this is just what the swimming pattern looks like. Next slide. To find out whether the larval eyes are really responsible for this movement, he killed them with a laser, so now they are gone. Yeah, so this is the laser cutter that you can nicely use in patent rays because it's all translucent and transparent, and whatever you see you can simply shoot away. Actually, with one eye left, it still works. This we know meanwhile, which is interesting. Next slide, please. By microscopy, he determined all the structural constraints of the eyes. Here you can just continue. So he found out about the exact anatomy of the cells. Yeah, next slide. So these are the pigment cells and the photoreceptor cells. Exactly. This is in electron optics, and he used electron optics to reconstruct these eyes and to also embed them into the total larval morphology, which is on the next slide. Yeah, determined the viewing angle of these larval eyes. Yeah, integrated into larval morphology. So this is all EM reconstruction, if you want. Then by Gaspar did a lot of neurobiology, which is on the next slides, to find out about the innervation of the larval eyes into the prototroph. This is the early axonal scaffold. And on the next slide, you can see that these larval eye photoreceptors, I think it's hard to go into detail here, but all the slide shows is that the larval eye photoreceptors are cholinergic. There's a certain marker for the larval eye photoreceptor, which is FVRI amide. And if you go to the next slide, I think this is better to explain. You can go to the model. There you see the photoreceptor of the larval eye, so the scheme, illustrating that the photoreceptor of the larval eye directly innervates the ciliated cells of the prototroph, of the ciliary girdle. So it's again a multifunctional cell that is both photosensitive and motor. It's a motor neuron, if you want. And the transmitter is acetylcholine. This is also clear because Fitzy-Bungerow-Toxin labels the ciliary girdle. This was also validated experimentally, if you go to the next slide. Yeah, because phototaxis is dead when you apply Bungerow-Toxin, which is a acetylcholine receptor inhibitor.
That's also a homology with vertebrates that insects do not have. Insects, Bungerow-Toxin does not block acetylcholine receptor function. There are binding sites for it, but it does not.
Okay.
It doesn't do anything. So this is another interesting case where you have a similarity with vertebrates that is missing in insects.
Yes, it's certainly also in this case then that the insect receptor is more derived so that it doesn't. It simply doesn't react in the same way. Yeah, exactly. So this is a nice thing. So far, everything that we tried in terms of pharmacology works. Next slide, please. And so this is now more or less the end. Gaspar found out how the ciliary phototaxis really works. So he looked into the ciliary beading. Here you see the metachronic ciliary beat of the swimming larvae under the microscope. Next slide, please. So he used so-called chymographs, which is just recording the pixels on one line and over time, and this is shown underneath. Now the white line is recorded over time, the pixels over time with the ciliary beading, and then gives a very specific pattern, and this is very nice to see whether there's any change in ciliary beading pattern. Yeah, and if you go to the next slide, Gaspar developed a device that he can use for selective eye illumination. So if you look on the right, there's a larvae underneath the cover slip, and you see that this device is able to selectively illuminate one eye and then look what happens with the ciliary beading. And this is visible on the next slides. Yeah, he did this with the left and with the right eye. This movie doesn't matter because it is not so nice anyway, so if you go on. What he found was simply that the illumination of one eye, which is approximately where the seven is in this picture, changed the beating pattern of the adjacent cilia, and this is shown underneath. So 20 milliseconds after the light is turned on, the ciliary beating pattern of the neighboring cell changes. And on the next slide you can see that this only affects the directly neighboring ciliated cells. Yeah, so in this case the eye next to ciliated cells number 12 is hit or is illuminated by light, and then the adjacent cilium changes the beating pattern and the others don't. And Gasper, so what we know is that upon illumination of one larval eye, the ciliated cells closest to the eye changes beating. Now, next slide, please. And he also found out the next question was whether the ciliary beating would be stronger or weaker. And this was easy to determine. If you go to the next slide, maybe we can skip this. He was visualizing the currents in the water generated by the cilia. And around the larvae, you see something that I like to call washing machine effect. So there are beats in the water. They are recorded over time. And you can see that on the dorsal side, this turbulence effect or this moving around of particles is weaker than on the ventral side. Can you see this?
Yeah. Yeah? So the field looks like the field of a dipole.
Yeah. Sorry?
The velocity field looks like a dipole.
I simply didn't understand it.
The velocity field looks like a dipole.
Yeah? Yes, okay, like a dipole. Yeah, sure. I understand now. Yes. There's all the beads in the water. Yeah. And with this, then, of course, he could visualize, if you go to the next slide, using the same system, he could show that actually the currents get slower next to the illuminated eye. So particles slow down next to the eye upon illumination. And now we are done with the experiments, and he put everything, he just went to the mathematician and asked him to model this. And this is on the next slide. Yeah. The mathematical model for platinum-ray swimming. So just to explain, I think the important parameters are the loop in L and the spin, the axial rotation. So the spin is the rotation of the larvae around itself, and the loop is the ratio between the ventral ciliary beating force and the dorsal ciliary beating. And I told you this is different on the dorsal and ventral side, so this is something more than one. And he determined it being 1.6 for the normal swimming. Exactly. And then all these morphological parameters went into the model, and on the next slide you can see then that it nicely recapitulated Platin-Reyes phototaxis. This is the computer simulation for this. It swims, so the white ball is then, the small white ball is the light, the direction of light. This is where the larva swims to. Now the light is on the other side and it will turn around.
I have a question.
Yes?
If you ablate one eye in the computer model, does it still work like it does in nature? Does it still
follow
the light like it does in nature?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It also makes sense, it's a long story, but sponges, for example, have these cells all around the periphery. That makes sense that it only works with one. But it is more clumsy. And then the next slide. Shows you the whole thing in an overview. So this resembles these swimming patterns you've seen before. Now the light comes from another direction, and they swim towards the light.
So these are the simulated larvae.
This is simulation, yes. And they in fact, this is 3D if you want, right? It's a 2D representation of a 3D helical swimming towards the light. And then, of course, you can test the model, whether or you can play with the model, change the parameters, and see how the swimming changes. If you go to the next slide, if you, for example, change the loop, yeah? So if dorsal and ventral ciliary beating are more or less the same, then you have a loop which is almost equals one, and then the helix gets a much longer wavelength and lower amplitude. And if you increase the loop, the helix would get a smaller wavelength and a stronger amplitude. And if you this you can simulate in Platin Reyes, so you can experimentally change the loop if you weaken the dorsal cilia by shaving. So this movie shows how Gaspar shaved off the dorsal cilia just to weaken them further in comparison to the ventral ones. And then he looked what happened to the swimming movement, and the difference was very clear, so that it followed the prediction of the model, and that the ablated cilia, ablated larvae, resembled this had the smaller wavelength and high amplitude in swimming. Okay, this was just to illustrate that also in terms of neurobiology, it's a nice model, and so this is the end of the presentation, and here are all the people who did the work. So thanks for listening.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments?
How does segmentation work in platin arrays?
How does what work?
Segmentation.
Segmentation. Okay. They are segmented. They have three sorts of segments. So the larva is already tripartite. It has three parts. Then the posterior portion subdivides into a second sort of segments, which we call larval segments. This happens simultaneously, as it does in the vertebrates, actually, and also in insects. So there's a second sort of segments that is simultaneously forming. And then the larvae, this larvae that is three-segmented with the larval segments, develops into a juvenile worm by segments sprouting from the posterior growth zone. So as in insects, yeah, or with the vertebrates with the tail bud, there is a posterior growth zone.
Is it known if it's oscillating? Are there oscillation in this posterior growth zone?
Like, yeah, as far as I know, there is data for another annelid that this Notch-Delta system may be active in the posterior growth zone, so that there are oscillations. But I think this information is for the leech. So it could well be that the segments are corresponding, and we have a postdoc in the lab who's now looking into the locomotor circuit, so into the central pattern generator of the trunk, and wants to see what the neuron types involved are and how it works.
Anybody else?
I'd like to know if you're looking for the histamine-gated chloride channel, which is the postsynaptic target for most rhabdomeric photoreceptors in arthropods.
Which channel was it?
The histamine-gated chloride channel.
Mm-hmm. We haven't looked yet, no.
Because this is a distinctive character of the arthropod compound I, and also I believe of mechanoreceptors.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we can certainly look into it. I can write it down and have a look whether we have the gene, yes. Histamine-gated, yeah.
Oh, just a quick question. Thetlev, earlier you were talking about the ciliary opsin-expressing photoreceptors in platyneuris, and you noted that they were in contact with the cerebral spinal fluid, or not the cerebral spinal fluid, but they were in contact, they were ciliated, and you made a connection between those and ciliated cells in the ventricles of ancestral vertebrates.
Yes.
I wonder if you would draw a connection between ependymal cells that line the ventricles of extant vertebrates, mammals, with photoreceptors. So is there another, is there a evolutionary sisterhood of ependymal cells which are ciliated and photoreceptor cells in vertebrates?
Well, there certainly is in fish, for example. So in mammals, I think there's evidence that some of the opsins are still expressed, but I'm not aware of any further information that there are active photoreceptors in the brain. But in lower vertebrates, of course, you find photoreceptors also with expressing ciliary opsin in the brain ventricles. And these are cerebrous fluids contacting neurons. So this is the work of Vig in Hungary and co-workers. So these cells do exist, and you can see them. I would totally agree that you can see them as remnants of these brain population of photoreceptors that existed in, or that always exists in invertebrate and vertebrate brains. And the story is even further complex because some of these cells also express this neuropsin, which is another type of opsin. And neuropsin we also found in the annelid. We don't know about the expression yet. So there could be yet another cell type located in the brain, and photoreceptor cell type also conserved. And I think for the lower vertebrates, what these ciliary photoreceptor related central spinal fluid contacting neurons are doing is unknown. Yeah, so the circadian clock is apparently set by the retinal ganglion cells. Maybe they do a similar thing, but or they are directly involved in the regulation of some physiology. Who knows? But I think this is very exciting, and these photoreceptors will tell a lot about the ancient brain because it all happened in the ocean.
Well, thanks again. Thank you very much.
Okay, so are you going to the whale watching now?
No, we have one more talk and then we go watch the whale.
Yeah. Okay, whoever has an additional question, of course, I'm glad to be contacted also by mail. Yeah? Okay. So then just write it down. My mail, I think you all have.
We have it. Yeah? We have it on the program. Yeah.
Yeah?
We have your
okay.
And we will post the talk in the website so people will have access to it if they want to go back to it. So that will work as well.
Okay.
Okay? Many thanks. It's
okay.
Worked very well. Thank you.
Yes, I'm glad it worked. And sorry again not to be there physically and personally.
Well, you'll miss the
have
waves.
A nice day.
Bye.
We could
bye.